I have a most interesting subject to discuss with you this morning. This is in the ministry of our Lord and Savior. When we were children in Sabbath school.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Fundamentalists Podcast.
Part five.
Wow. Fifth episode. How are you feeling about that?
I'm feeling great. We've done one a week for 5 weeks, but it's actually only been 2 weeks.
Yeah, because so we did a few extra.
I think we're doing pretty good.
I think so, too. If you're just joining us, my name is Elliot Morgan, and I do stand-up comedy and internet stuff, and I also happen to very much enjoy philosophy and religion and all of those wonderful things, and I'm joined by
Peter Rollins. I'm a philosopher and a writer and a public speaker, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm also privileged to be the housemate of Elliot Morgan.
Yes, we live together here in Los Angeles, California. How's your week going?
Week's been good. I've just spent 5 days in Texas. Was in Austin, Dallas, Houston, and San Antonio.
That's all of Texas.
That's all of Texas. We drove it.
Yeah.
So we didn't go too. It was, you know, it's easy enough. Like 4.5 hours was the longest drive. Man, I really like the attitude and the feel of Texas.
Yeah, it's cool.
People are super kind, but they're rough around the edges.
Yeah.
And I really like the kind of conservatism as well. Like I went into a shop. There were a couple of shops where they were playing Christian music. And they had, like, they were selling Jesus junk.
Yeah.
In the actual store.
Yeah, JJ. Jesus junk. Yeah. It's baked into the culture, for sure.
Fascinating. And loads of military stuff as well. Like, yeah. There was lots of kind of, like, pro-military. It was just a really interesting...
It's America.
Vibe,
like,
yeah.
Legit America.
Here's one thing about it that was interesting to me is that I noticed that there was the word pride was used a lot in billboards and in magazines. And it felt like... That was a big thing in Texas, and I felt that maybe that's actually because Texas feels under siege.
Yeah.
Because usually reaction formation is you kind of push out the opposite. If you feel threatened and you feel like impotent, you do the mm-hmm. opposite. And I kind of felt that, like, maybe if you're in Texas, you feel like, you know, a little bit under siege by the rest of the coasts.
I think they've definitely always had like an outsider perspective on things, and for good reason.
Yeah, and I like that a lot. Like I like it reminded me a little bit about Northern Ireland, because the community I grew up in felt like a community under siege.
Yeah,
and so I kind of understand that vibe, and I like the toughness. You know, LA, you get a bit weak. Living in LA.
You do. You get soft.
You get soft. And, you know, I need a little bit of toughness in my life.
I myself was traveling as well. I was in Boston for the past few days.
That's a tough city.
It is. And in that vein, Mike Falzone, my one of my best friends and stand-up comrade, was in a Dunkin' Donuts there, and he ordered a coffee. And they messed his order up, and they just kind of put it down next to, you know, where you pick up the coffees, but they didn't say his name or anything. And he said that he was like, is this my coffee? And the person's response was, yeah, take it. And he said it made his heart warm, because he was like, I'm on the East Coast. They don't give a crap that they messed it up. They're not trying to be like fake nice to me. They're just like, I like that.
I like that. I miss that. That's like Belfast, you know?
It's hard to find that around here at all. It's even hard to find it sometimes, I think, in like areas of Florida where I'm from. There's like that kind of southern niceness that can be its own kind of sugary sweet thing. But there's something so refreshing about a slight dickishness.
Yeah. I mean, in Boston, it's inhabited by a lot of like Irish first.
Oh my gosh, dude.
Is it first generation, you call it, or a second generation?
Definitely. I don't know, but there's some accents floating around. Yeah. And I like the one night I did the performance that I wasn't super happy with, and I was like by myself walking around, and it's just a beautiful, I mean, I love the city so much, but I found like, I was like, I punched into Google Irish bar, because I was like, I know that'll be like lively and nice and open. And sure enough, it was a nice time.
So, is that right? Oh, yeah. Very cool. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, we had a similar experience when we were on the road. I was doing an event in, where was it? It was Dallas. Mm-hmm. And just halfway through my bit, the fire alarm went off. Yeah. Everyone thought it was part of the thing because I was doing like 5 minutes of kind of warm-up comedy
classic
stuff.
Peter Rollins move.
So nobody moved when the light started flashing and the woman came on. I was so tempted as like there's 1,200 people who had to evacuate. Humble brag.
Yeah. They were 1,214 people.
Well, they weren't there for me, sadly. They were there for Rob Bell, who I was touring
with. That's not true.
Yeah. But when
10 of them were definitely...
10 of them were definitely there for me. But on the way, I was so tempted while everyone was evacuating to say, on the way out, could everyone just remember to buy a book? But then I thought, if there really was a fire, that would haunt me for the rest of my life.
Yeah, if somebody died in the fire and the last words they heard were you going, hey, don't forget to buy a book.
On the way out. So I was telling you that story, and then you kind of bettered me.
Yeah, so I had this exact similar... completely opposite thing where before I was doing a thing called NACA, which is National Association for Campus Activities.
With 12 people in your audience.
12 people in my audience, all of whom were there for me though. No, it was like, you know, I don't know, 500, 600 people. And there's all different acts that perform for NACA. And one of them was a magician. And the magician turned a cage of doves into a parrot using magic.
Can you just explain for a second how you do it, how he did it? Because I want to come back to it. Like what he did, what did it look like?
What if I was like, well, he didn't cover it with anything. I saw the doves magically morph together and become one solid parrot. Like if I just described the most magical thing. He had a satin, like a black satin thing that he put over a cage of doves, which is so weird. And then he like, they disappeared into the satin.
He kind of crushed the cage.
Yeah, which I like to think is like the prestige and all those doves are just... dead, but I know they're not.
Yeah, well, that's what I was about to say. I wonder if like actually people are watching. I go, that's amazing. And they go like, no, he's got 12 crushed doves, dead, blood everywhere.
There's just blood seeping under. Yeah.
The guy who has to clean up at the end comes in with the mop.
There's feathers flying as he's like dusting him into his dustpan. He grabs it and then it starts morphing into something. And it turns out that the doves turned into a beautiful parrot, which is really weird on a symbolic level because parrots remind me of like Margaritaville and doves are like a symbol of peace and love and unity. So it's funny that you're like, I'm going to take these beautiful, majestic creatures of love and peace and turn it into like something that I associate with pirates.
A rat.
Yeah, exactly. But anyway, long story short, the parrot decided to fly away and flew up into the rafters and continued to go, wah, wah! Throughout the performance of the warm-up guy, which led me to thinking that I was in some sort of a Black Mirror episode. And I was freaking out. And then they cleared out the auditorium and they cleared out hundreds and hundreds of people. And then they cleared out the performers. And I was like, this isn't good. Cause it was like two more acts before I had to go on stage. And I was like, this parrot's really going to kind of throw a kink into the whole, you know, vibe of the place. And
so what did he think was going to happen? Like, has this never happened to him before where the parrot's just flown off?
It couldn't have happened. The way he was trying to get that parrot back was he got on a ladder, went three steps up on the ladder, extended his arm and was like, hey, please come back. Please come back. And then when that didn't work, he went up a fourth rung on the ladder. But the parrot was in this like giant ceiling. I was bursting out laughing, but I couldn't, the poor guy, he couldn't, you know, ruining the convention. Anyway, they brought everybody back in and I performed and it was what it was. So yeah, we had similar, I was hoping that happened on the same night because it would be like we were living in two different parallel realities, but we're not because nothing like that ever actually happened.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and they had a lot of balloon animal or balloon makers. What do you call them? Balloon specialists?
Balloon artists.
Balloon artists.
Yeah. They told me before, NACA has all sorts of acts that colleges can bring on. And the types of acts that they have are a lot of balloon animal. And so there's like just like these college students running around with, they just have balloon animals. And I'm like, how many colleges are these balloon people going to get to go to? You know, nothing against balloon people.
No, but balloon people are great. But I thought that was more for kids than college students.
Right. But I think I remember being in college and stuff like that would be kind of popular because it was just a nice, innocent thing you could do that would like make something more.
Well, at
fun
least you're never
students.
You're never going to piss off anybody.
Yeah, exactly. Never,
unless you create like a balloon thing of Milo or something.
Right. Yeah, which is, takes a long time, and it'd be more impressive than anything.
Yeah, I think everyone would be impressed.
Yeah,
for or against, to be like, oh, that's pretty damn good.
Right. Oh, you made a racist balloon. That's a hard hard task. But anyway, it was a fun, magical trip. So what are we talking about today?
Today, well, you know, I thought, inspired by something I did in Houston, we could talk about nothing.
I love it.
Yeah, because I went to one of my favorite places in the world is the Rothko Chapel. That's in this just basically a suburban area in Houston.
Yeah.
And it was built, well, it was built by an architect, but it was designed by Mark Rothko,
cool,
the artist. And he has these paintings in it. And then there's a sculpture by an artist I love called Barnett Newman outside.
Now, is this like, do they still have church in this chapel?
No, see, this is the interesting thing. It's kind of like a chapel. They use it as a kind of multi-faith chapel, mm-hmm, but I think it could be better described as a no-faith chapel.
Yeah.
You go in and there are these massive black paintings on every wall that Mark Rothko did just shortly before he killed himself. Because as he got older, his paintings got darker and darker until they became basically black.
Just like a painting, like describe a painting. Like, is it like a painting of just black?
Yeah, so yeah.
Okay, black canvas?
Like basically black canvas.
That's one of those things where when growing up that like I'd be walking through the museum.
I could do that.
Yep, do the classic like, I don't know why I'd go there, I could do that.
Yeah. Well, yeah, no, they're basically black canvas, color field canvases. But with slight variations and, you know, in each of them, and some of them are triptychs. But when you walk in, It's quite powerful. It's quite overwhelming in a sense. There's these incredibly huge black paintings on every wall, and silence and very minimal design. And it's basically a reflection on the void, on the abyss, mm-hmm, on nothingness.
That's cool, man.
Yeah.
I saw the photo you posted that was like, I don't know, some sort of a statue or some kind of a...
Yeah, that's Broken Obelisks by Barnett Newman, which was dedicated to Martin Luther King Jr.
Oh, really?
And cool. It's a kind of cool sculpture, and you can kind of get a few different meanings from it.
So funny, man. I was walking by, there's so many beautiful churches and chapels and stuff in Boston, and it's interesting that it's the same thing in LA. If you find typically an old building like that, that's like historic, it's more often than not going to be some sort of a no faith or multi faith kind, yeah, of a building. I don't know what that is and how that happened exactly, but it's, yeah, interesting. But yeah,
and Rothko wasn't religious at all. Like, he was not a religious individual in any standard way.
That explains, I think,
he
was problem.
Was that, yeah?
If he'd have gotten into religion, maybe he could have been. Maybe those could have been paintings of pure white.
Yeah, or like, what was that guy you talked about last week? The guy who has all those shops with Jesus images?
Yes. You are, of course, referencing Kincaid, Thomas Kincaid.
Thomas Kincaid, yeah. He could maybe, if he
could have been a Kincaid.
Yeah, he could have been a Thomas Kincaid of the art world.
And instead, where is he now?
Where
Rothko
is he now?
Yeah. Chapel. Sad, sad thing. So let's talk about nothing. What kinds of nothing? What do you mean?
Yeah, so one of the biggest themes in philosophy is the theme of nothingness. The other is being. What is stuff? But then there's this weird question of nothingness. What is nothing?
Because nothing is something.
Because there's two types of nothing in a sense. There's nothing that is nothing, and then there's nothing that is something. And the nothing that is nothing is like the difference between not talking to somebody because you're being quiet, or not talking to someone because you're communicating something. So there are two types of silence. You know, there's a silence of nothing, and there's a silence that communicates.
This makes me very uncomfortable. I'm already uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Because I know exactly what you're talking about, and I don't like it. Because the not actively not talking and withhold, that's withholding, and it's an action, right? So it has a purpose and it has a meaning, and you're trying to send a message by not saying anything. Is that version of nothing?
That version of nothing is, yeah. So the nothingness actually is full of content, weirdly. It has a substance.
Tells you more than it would have, or that, it tells you more than if you had chosen to not, to say something.
That's it. I mean, that's the funny thing, is sometimes you communicate more by what you don't say than what you do. And if you're talking to somebody, you can tell a lot about them, not just by what they say, but actually by what they don't talk about.
You know, I've had people notice this in the current climate that we're in certain areas I've just grown kind of more silent in. with whatever issue of the month that the nation happens to be dealing with. And it's interesting because there are people who do notice and who do take interest in it. And it's, I can, even though I'm talking to fewer people when that happens, because I sometimes will respond and be like, look, I don't know. And I've gotten some DMs from people who ask, you know, questions about why I haven't said such and such about such and such thing and all that. And it's like, whenever I do end up talking to those people, I can have a more meaningful conversation with them than if I just got on and was like, blah, 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 here's what I think. So,
and to be honest, you know, I say, if I don't know you, I don't know whether you're not talking about something because, again, because which is it? Is it because it's something that you haven't thought about, that it's not something you consider that it's an area where you feel an expert, you feel that you should talk into, or is it something you're not talking about because it means something? And
yeah.
So people, a lot of people assume, we all do it, I assume certain things about people, but actually it's even hard to tell what a person's not communicating or communicating when you know them well. That's why in analysis you have to take years. So we're very quick to think we know other people, mm-hmm. and so why they're not talking about something. But there is still this interesting thing that again, in there's a thing, free association, which you know about in psychoanalysis, is the idea that...
Yes, I do.
Yeah, you just talk about anything.
Baloney.
anything and everything that comes to mind. And the idea is actually that you're asked to free associate, but the trick is you can't. And that's the point. The point is we can't free associate. As soon as you start talking, very quickly you'll come to something that you can't talk about. And the analyst is not interested so much in what you're saying. They're interested in when you hesitate or when it seems like your words are going around something.
I had a thing. I just came from therapy today, did a little Saturday therapy, humble brag. And I had a thing that where I was like, definitely I heard myself have a slip of the tongue. Mm. And it wasn't anything bad or like deep or anything, but it was something where I was just like, whoop, whoop, whoop. And then I kind of quickly like reworded what I said. And I don't think he noticed, my therapist. Yeah. And I was like, but maybe he did. And he just doesn't, you know, care.
Yeah.
But like, cause not everything is, you know, massively important. But it was definitely one of those things where I thought about my slip of tongue and I definitely was like, I both knew why I quickly corrected myself because it made me sound shallow, and I also know that it was true. So it was like quick by myself, I was like, like, oh no, I just learned something because I had that little, anyway, that's
not. Oh, yeah. No, slips of the tongue are fascinating, and that's often where the truth comes out.
Yeah, it's real, but, real fun. But yeah, sorry.
Yeah, but in that, in an example where you're in therapy and somebody says always talking about their mother, right? And you go, okay, they're always talking about their mom, and maybe you can bring something out of that. But also the fact that they never talk about their father, mm-hmm. is also telling. So they're not talking about something, or their brother or their sister. And that, or for example, someone can't remember a whole period of their life. That nothingness actually tells you something. That's like, oh my goodness, why have you blanked? And there can be a whole variety of reasons, but it's interesting.
Yeah.
In fact, and that's why sculptors as well, they talk about when you look at a sculpture, don't just look at what is there, also look at the space in the sculpture, mm-hmm. because often artists are working more with the space between things.
Yeah.
Because that is part of the sculpture.
That's cool. I like that. Yeah. I like that a lot. So that's nothing of that is nothing, or that's nothing that is something.
Yeah.
Those are all nothings that are something. So going back to the nothing that's nothing, and this is going to, that saying those words in my mind makes me think philosophy 101, like what is like, yeah. Like it sounds kind of, I don't know what I can take from it that's,
yeah,
substantial.
Well, I mean, at first, and this is the great thing, I think as we talk, it'll become evident this is actually has real world value. It's not just sitting around talking about, you know, the nothing. But
yeah, I want to
put a pin in that.
Put a pin in it.
Is that what they say?
Yeah, put a pin in it. Go put a pin in it. It sounds so rude. Hold that thought also sounds rude. I'm like, I'm not going to hold my thought. Yeah. You hold my thought. But yeah, if you could hold your thought, that thought. I went down this rabbit hole where I was trying to wrap my head around a certain person, and I started getting into Jung, and we've talked about Jung a little bit, and my favorite stand-up joke that I have is about Mr. Carl Jung, and I have always liked him, anything that I read from him and all this stuff. But then I started getting into this really interesting, I started to try to figure out the difference between Jung, and this is just going to be you going like, you know, this is going to sound dumb, but I just was putting in like name versus name to figure out.
No,
like,
no, that's a good way to do it. Yeah.
Yeah. So, but when I put in Jung versus Lacan, there was like nothing except there was an article saying that the idea of comparing Jung and Lacan is you know, it doesn't happen because psychoanalysts don't even discuss Jung.
Yeah.
Like, he doesn't even come into the conversation. And that brought me back to what you were saying, which is that Jung is not a traditional psychoanalyst. And then I started looking into Jung more, and it was a very interesting thing because it was about this idea of like, and then that led me to a really fun video that didn't make any sense. That was just a clip of Jordan Peterson followed by a clip of Zizek. And I was like, obviously I love Zizek and I think he's so cool. But like the article was about like, well, there's two videos. The first was Peterson talking about Jung and talking about the happy hero tale versus Freud's kind of sad hero tale, and how he sides with Jung over Freud, which opened up in my mind. That's kind of where I was like, I don't think that's good. I don't like that. But then Zizek had his whole thing where he just got really pissed off on the microphone because people kept calling him dogmatic or something like that, or started accusing him of being a Lacanian or he started saying that like his popularity may be like a thing that's just in an effort to distract from the point he's making, to invalidate him, because if he becomes this sort of caricature, funny, vulgar guy, people don't have to listen to his ideas. And he seemed to be kind of saying that. And then in the comments, people were like, stop overthinking it. You just don't have anything important to say. And they started going after him. But it was a wormhole that I got into that just made me go like, oh man, the world of philosophy itself is exhausting. Like the people and the opinion. And I was like, it's like, I don't know how you do it, because it just seems like it reminded me a little bit of the world of comedy, where you can get kind of like, no, this person's funny, that person's not funny, and you're dumb if you think that, or you're a bad person if you agree with that comedian. Yeah. And it's like, but even that didn't have the level of like vitriol and anger that these philosophy kids had.
There are some crazy, I've seen hilarious things in the philosophy world where people act like school kids, high school kids. It's very funny.
Yeah.
And get into Twitter wars and it's really hilarious.
Long comment threads and just like, you effing dude. You know, and then they're throwing out all the little.
Oh yeah, I know some philosophers who act like children. Funnily enough, Kierkegaard said of himself, but a similar thing to what Zizek said. Kierkegaard said, "I've become a clown who's in a tent that's on fire." So he's in this circus tent and he's shouting at everybody, "The tent is on fire," and everybody's laughing because he's a clown.
Yeah.
And then everyone dies. And so the idea is that basically Kierkegaard is saying, you know, I'm treated like a clown, and so my message is no longer heard.
Yeah,
and
that's a very interesting, because it also kind of flies in the face of a lot of thoughts on comedy, which is that it's the jester who can say the thing, the truth that other people can't, because they're quote unquote beneath contempt, which is from a video that I watched, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, so sorry to derail the conversation like that, but it was a revelation on my part to see the
chaos.
Infighting. Yeah, yeah. It's like, I'm just trying to get bearings, you know, why Jung is not like Lacanian, and my conclusion in my mind that I kind of pieced together haphazardly was that basically Jung is the collective unconscious thing, and all that is very kind of almost mystical, and more of a, he seems to be more of like a guru type thing, whereas Freud and the traditional psychoanalysts are not like that at all.
Yeah,
there's much more.
And Jung, and we should do an episode on this now. Jung, is very much as a more mystical thinker. Jung is more into this idea that the antagonism of life, the trauma of life, is a contingent thing that, you know, can in a sense be overcome. Whereas within a kind of Freudian frame, trauma is actually hard baked into reality.
Mm-hmm.
And so there isn't a kind of the way to embrace life in its fullness is actually to somehow kind of make your trauma work for you and to kind of like wrestle with it and face it. But actually, in a sense, there's no getting away from it. I mean, that's a very superficial
sure.
distinction, but I think it's an important one. You know, that's Jung got very much in his later work into a much more kind of religious frame of mind.
Right.
Yeah.
So what would be then, I guess, with Kierkegaard being like, because he kind of did the same, right? I mean, being because we were going to talk about with nothingness and like existentialism and how that relates to all that. Yeah. But Kierkegaard being an existentialist, isn't that kind of like a religious thing? Or is existentialism more just like, no, nothing is where you achieve? I don't.
Yeah, well, no, existentialism is a funny old thing because it is, in some respects, it is the it's an outworking of Christianity in a sense. Like it's people like the proto-existentialist, you think of Pascal, and then you the first existentialist, you think of Nietzsche and Kierkegaard, who are both very religious, Christian in their own very different ways. But then it's funny because existentialism has two sides to it. You have these kind of confessional existentialists like Kierkegaard, like Gabriel Marcel, and then you have one people like Sartre, and you have Nietzsche, who are very kind of like kind of not confessional in their existentialism. So existentialism is all across the board, but they all kind of have some similarity.
Sartre is my favorite brand of breath mints. Anyway, Pete, what were we talking about today?
Oh yeah, we have to get back to the nothing.
Sorry.
We went off on a nice little tangent.
I asked
there.
You to hold the thought. Did you hold the thought? Were you able to successfully?
Oh yeah. Well, I think we're still kind of on that. That oh yeah, nothingness as something. I mean, I think another example of this is the nothingness that is before birth. Mm-hmm. We don't even think about. It's a nothingness, it's nothing. It doesn't seem to cause many of us concern.
Isn't that interesting? Yeah. That is so interesting.
Yeah, I mean, we weren't around for a long time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Whoa, I've never thought about the fact that I don't think about the fact that I was not here and then I was.
Yeah. So that's kind of like a nothingness. It's not like you're repressing that. Probably it's like actually it just has a no interest to you.
Weird.
Yeah.
So that would be a nothing that's a nothing.
Yeah, for most people.
Whoa, that's a crazy thing because my follow-up to the nothing is nothing thing was going to be like, even if nothing is nothing, isn't it still something? But it's like, I mean, you're right that there's just like no interest.
Yeah, there's no interest. You know, it's like zero interest. I mean, I'm sure there are some people who that does cause a certain kind of like anxiety, but not for most people.
Yeah.
But whereas the nothingness that seems to wait for us at the end of our lives, that's a nothingness, it is something.
How good does your life have to be if somebody's like, how's your day going? You're like, I'm just kind of like stressed out about like the fact that I didn't used to be here. And now I am. Like that just to me that all that is just, that is a symptom of incredible boredom.
Yeah.
I was just like, I'm all bent out of shape because like I wasn't always present on this.
I guess, but if you think about it enough, it might freak you out.
I guess if you really go down that wormhole.
It kind of feels like you have to get really high.
It does.
Then that will really freak you out.
Dude, like I was partaking of the devil's herb at one point, and I keep coming back to this stand-up bit about people like it's like an anti-weed joke, but it's like because I think that's funnier than the comedian who's like weed's so cool because that's boring, but I like the idea of a bit and I the only reason I'm bringing it up is because I keep coming back to it, but it's like the idea of being like medicinal marijuana, when people are like, well, marijuana is just like, it's perfect if it's for medicinal use. Like it helps with this, and this, and you'll be anything. It'll be like cancer and headaches and, you know, menstrual stuff, like anything. People will say that weed makes better. And then my rebuttal would just be like, yeah, of course it does. You're high the entire time. Like yeah. That's like, there's no magical like thing to this drug. You're just happier.
Yeah.
So of course you're happier with whatever situation you're in. Anyway.
Yeah.
So
wow,
that I am in a tangential
yeah.
spiral, and I'm so sorry.
That's a beautiful analogy for some of the stuff we talk about. That is the kind of the not getting to the point is probably where the most enjoyable bit is, you know.
Except for the iTunes reviews that are like, Elliot, stop it. Well, that's okay.
But there's a great Islamic parable about death, which is the nothingness that awaits us. And you'll know this. It's a very famous one about a guy. He has a servant, and the servant is told to, you know, go down into the marketplace, get some provisions. So he's down there, he's shopping, he's going through the market, talking to people, and he brushes past this woman, and he turns and he looks at her in the eyes, and he realizes that he's looking at death. And then there's a scowl on death's face.
I had this at a bar the other night.
Oh, yeah. It's a good shut-up story.
Yeah.
And the guy's like, oh, my goodness, death is there to get me. He goes white as a sheet and runs back to the merchant. He tells the merchant what happened. Says, listen, death is after me. The merchant says, take my fastest horse and gallop north. If you gallop as fast as you can and don't stop, you will get to the neighboring city of Samarra by midnight. Hide there. So after the servant takes off, the merchant decides to confront death. So the merchant goes down into the marketplace, and sure enough, he finds death. She's sitting having a coffee, and he sits down and he says to her, why are you scaring my servant? And the death looks at him and goes, oh, no, I wasn't trying to scare him. I was just surprised. I was shocked. She said, like, I saw him walking through the markets, talking to people, taking his time. And I thought to myself, that guy's got to get his skates on, because I've got an appointment with him at midnight in Samarra.
That's really funny.
It's good, isn't it?
That's funny.
And it's beautiful. It's very funny until you realize what it means, and then it's really depressing. It's like, you cannot escape your appointment
yeah.
with death.
Yeah.
And in fact, the very thing you're doing to avoid it might be the very thing that gets you there faster, like exercise, for example.
Yeah, you know? You're right.
So that's a beautiful, I think, analogy of kind of, oh, death is a nothing, it is something, it terrifies us. We often repress it.
That's so good. I love that. Like the that sounds like the end scene of a horror movie.
Oh yeah.
You know how like horror movies always end with some weird cliffhanger that...
Oh yeah, that would be a really good short film.
Well, you know? Why don't you get the one under your belt?
Oh yeah, yeah.
You know, by the way, congrats on that.
Oh, thank you. Going to be shooting in a couple of weeks.
Very exciting.
Yeah. Oh yeah, but here's where the existentialists come in.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah. There's a death that is, there's a nothingness that is at the end of life. But the existentialists are the ones who come in and say, but there is a nothingness that is a part of life. It's not just that you're approaching nothingness, it's that actually nothingness is part of what it means to be human. It's inside us.
That's where I get hung up on a lot of the stuff in our culture right now. That's not even like the fringe stuff and like a lot of the live your best life now type stuff. That's mm-hmm. where the self-help stuff that I enjoy falls apart a little yeah. bit, because they try to ignore that and they try to say like, and it's like this thing where there's like this like pseudo profound thing where you can be like, well, you know, happiness like isn't real. Like you can't have happiness, which I definitely have said that and partially do believe. But at the same time, like I'm happy constantly. Mm-hmm. So it's hard to like see that. But I also feel like there's the extreme that happens in the self-help world where they ignore the nothingness that's a part of life. And, yeah. and it's even it's happening in a lot of the political stuff where it's just like, you know, even especially in the this country in particular, and it's like if you work hard, if you do that thing, if you achieve that, if you get that woman, if you, you know, put your shoulders back and you present your best forward-thinking self and all that, then you will be higher on some hierarchy, yeah. which might be true, but then that implies that that's going to give you some kind of thing, and that you're not still going to carry around something in you that desires to be complete.
Yeah. I mean, that's the kind of existential critique of self-help in a sense. The existentialists would say that kind of fleeing from kind of the doubt, unknowing, the sense of meaninglessness, all of these experiences, and we'll come back to them in a second, but that those experiences of lack, of nothingness, of not, say, not having certainty, not having meaning, that instead of running from them, we have to learn how to live with them, and actually how to not only live with them, but to turn them into something positive.
I have a thought on that I want to hit in just a second.
Perfect. Well,
but
you can do it now if you want.
I was going to talk about this wine.
Oh, yes. Oh, Please do.
It's called Porter and Plot.
It's very tasty, actually.
It's really good, and it's from TryWink. Well, Wink. WINC.com, and you can go to trywink.com/thefundamentalists.
Are you getting it right this time?
I am. Yeah, barely. It's called Porter and Plot, and it's a 2016 Pinot Noir from the Sonoma Coast. And it's a cool bottle that took, I'm going to be honest with you guys, I couldn't open it.
Listen, can I say the thing about the bottle opener?
Yeah, man.
Because it was a Christmas present, and it's beautiful, but Elliot got a Christmas present from his beloved mother, I've met. She is the most lovely person.
Lovely person.
And she bought, and it is a bottle opener that is as big as a bottle of wine.
It's giant.
And we have not got to be able to work it once.
No.
In fact, it chipped that.
It did chip.
We can put people on the moon, but you can't.
Can't get a good bottle opener.
And it's the size of a bottle. Like it's
huge.
It is kind of like, it's over-promising with its size and with the fact that it's like takes
I know, it really is.
It is over-promising.
Something that's a little, all right. Yeah. It's definitely
it's overcompensating.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. If we were to be invaded in our home, it would be one of the first things I would grab.
Yeah.
It's like very easily weaponized.
Yes. Could probably take an eye out more than they could take a cork out.
But if you go to trywink.com/thefundamentalists, you can get $25 off and you can get really cool looking wines that you can probably open a little better than we can. And if you do that, it helps support our wine habit.
Yes.
And gin habit. Anyway, I was thinking about this idea that you were saying of the thing of the nothing and like speaking the nothing thing and the lack all this stuff. And so I am reading a book right now by my therapist called How Did My Life Get to This or How Did My Life Come to This? And it's by Dr. Gary Penn, book available now. And he, and it talks about a similar idea, but it's much more, you know, kind of, not to say practical, and this isn't practical, but he talks about the lacks that we have that we operate out of, you know, that like our childhood self is kind of like, you know, calling the shots a lot of times because we don't want to confront the things that the child doesn't in us doesn't want us to look at. And so he has this method where it's like when you can catch a glimpse of some kind of unconscious thought or unconscious fear, he's like, take it. And he's like, close your eyes. And he goes, just say it. He and then validate it. And so the one in the book talks about this guy basically fearing that he's not a real man and that he can't satisfy a woman. And so in the book, he's like, okay, close your eyes and say, I can't satisfy
a woman. Did you just say, I have a friend? I have a friend.
And the guy feels
and in can't satisfy women.
And there's, and then in page 22, there's a different person.
Yes.
And then not me said it definitely resonated because I think, you know, any guy has that kind of like, you know, but he's like, close your eyes and say it over and over and over again. And he's like, maybe you can't. He's like, maybe you never will be happy. Maybe you're not a good X, Y, and Z. Maybe you're not good at your job. Maybe you are kind of an imposter and you're faking it. Maybe that, he's like, validate it and own it and then speak it over and over and over again. And then when after you've done that, take a step back and as your adult self go, okay, and reassess the situation. That's but he's it. Like, that's like, he's like, the unconscious things are these like, and these fears that you have that aren't, that you're not enough. Are like cockroaches that run away and you have all these defense mechanisms that try to hide from that. And if you can grab one of those cockroaches, which is disgusting, and just like put it in the sunlight, it's gonna wither and die.
That's it. I mean, that's one of the, that's kind of like the kind of first step in analysis. And sometimes it's enough is to try to name.
I've been seeing this guy for a long time.
But it is like sometimes it's enough. Now, sometimes it isn't enough. That's the thing. But sometimes it's enough to simply try to name what you are most afraid of that you cannot even admit to yourself. And the, as you say, the very act of bringing that truth to the light of day is itself transformative.
Yeah.
There's the old religious saying, you shall know the truth and the truth shall set you free. That's kind of like an ancient way of saying this, is that we do want to look at our truth, the truth of the deepest, you know, humiliations and horrors. But actually, when you don't know the truth, it damages you. But if you can speak it in some way, it actually, you find freedom in that. So yeah, that's it, and it's a very powerful thing to do.
I was like, I was going in Boston. I was doing like that after show meet and greet type of thing, and every now and then somebody would come up who had never heard of me and never seen any of my stuff before, and they were always the ones that I was like most interested in hearing their opinions, because I was like, I obviously, you know, people, if they have a positive bias toward me from internet stuff, then it doesn't mean that they'll find that they'll, you know, like be an honest critic toward me or whatever. And but as I was thinking, like, somebody at one point was joking that I didn't really care or something like that, and I was like, no, I do care. I was like, I was like, trust me, I'm sincere very rarely, but when I was like, I definitely want to know what this person thinks, because I want to know that what I'm doing is actually funny on stage. And then I was thinking about that later, and I was like, well, clearly, even after this amazing show that happens where it's like packed and it's like, I know it went great, there's still something in me that's going like, you're not funny. Like, you need that person to like da 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 da. And so then I'm like, okay, if I'm following that advice, the maybe that there's a gap between where I'm at and where I think I should be to either deserve what I'm getting or to earn what I want. It requires me to like just accept that and be like, no, there's a part of me that's going to be fearful probably forever that I am not funny at all.
Yeah.
And thankfully I have people like you to remind me that for sure I'm not.
You're not funny. Exactly. Yeah. I mean, this is the, like, this is you, what you're doing is you're loosening up repression, like, especially for neurotics. There's a real tendency to repress, which means, and you push your stuff down, you push it down, you don't look at it, you don't face it, but it's like a pressure cooker, and you put a top on that, and it gets the hotter and hotter, and the steam has nowhere to go, and then it explodes. It explodes in crying for no reason. Mm-hmm. Someone says something very small to you, and you get upset, or exploding in anger at the smallest thing, or as a headaches, or anything that steam eventually pops somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
But the more you can loosen the lid and let the steam out, the healthier generally as a person you'll be. And so in one sense that's a psychoanalytic nothing that we're talking about. Is a psychoanalytic nothing is that you repress stuff so much that you even forget it. And the weird thing is, I had a dream last night that actually reflected this a little bit, but what you do is you displace. So what happens is, for example, you might get really angry with someone called John. For no apparent, you don't know this person, but you just met them, they're called John, and they really annoy you. And actually, what's happening is maybe your real anger is at someone else who had the name John or Jack or something, but you've so hidden that from yourself that you've forgotten it. Mm-hmm. It's nothing, it's not there, but it actually comes out in a displaced way against somebody else who hasn't done anything wrong whatsoever.
It's so fat. I got pissy last night for like no reason, and somebody called me out on it, and I was like, I'm fine. And then afterward I was like, no, I am pissy, and I was like, I have no idea why. No one's done anything, I'm very happy, but I was like, something is angsty, and I was like, oh, there's more, you know. It's fine.
Yeah.
What do you mind saying what the dream was? Do you, or is it not appropriate?
Yeah, I wonder, or it might just be, I think it might just be a little bit boring. It's convoluted because it's connected with other things, so I think it'd actually just be boring.
Sure.
But it was the dream itself, the structure of it was, it was something to do with me being in a shop. I was in this shop.
You looked at death.
And I looked at death. She pointed at me. I know, but they...
You're like, I'm going to have to horse gallop a long way to get to so-and-so, wherever that place was, by midnight. Because you're here in
Samara.
Los Angeles.
Oh, yeah. Well, I was in John Vervedos. That was the shop I was in.
Of course, it was. Yeah.
I displaced... So the way that the people in the shop were treating me, I realized was the way I thought some other people had treated me. And I've displaced it onto a completely different scenario, completely different people, but it led me back to something. I was like, oh, I need to think about that.
Yeah, that's,
you know, I need to bring that to mind.
Do you mind if I ask how they had been treating you? Was it demeaning or some kind of a...
Yeah, it was funny because it was just with a complete indifference.
Ooh.
But what was interesting to me is, thankfully in the dream I was completely fine about it. I was like, oh yeah, they're treating me like that, but that's not great.
Isn't that crazy? I've had that in dreams where I'm like, yeah, that's exactly how I would react. When I wake up, I'm like, well, I reacted exactly how I would react in that scenario.
Yeah, and that's a good sign. Like, again, like less repression probably, you know, you're not exploding. But The philosopher Tillich and theologian Tillich, he beautifully put this idea of the nothingness in life into three. And the three were death and fate, which are connected. Death is like, you know, you're going to die and that affects your life. Fate is, you know, not just you're going to die, but actually death could happen at any moment. Fate is the idea that, oh my goodness, I could leave the house and get hit by a car, or not leave the house and get electrocuted or whatever. So fate is this experience that death is always around. The second he called guilt and condemnation, which is the sense that you're not living up to something. So guilt is simply a word for I'm not living up to something I feel I should be living up
that,
to.
Yeah, I had that. After yesterday, I'd reflected on my bad mood and I felt guilty over having done nothing, because it was like the day after my birthday, and I like slept in and like was just kind of a piece of crap and watched. People requested or suggested that we watch The Good Place, which, by the way, fantastic show.
Oh, right.
And I binge watched like 8 episodes.
Has it got Macaulay Culkin in it?
It's got Matthew McConaughey as Macaulay Culkin.
Okay.
Yeah. for those who's coming to the podcast, last week, Pete thought Matthew McConaughey was the star of Home Alone. So now you're all caught up.
Yeah.
I like to think of somebody who just hears that as the first time listener and doesn't. Anyway, yeah, but I was like thinking about the guilt, the I hadn't lived up to what I should have been living up to that day.
Yeah, I mean, guilt is just a technical term for that experience. It's nothing kind of like religious or anything. It's a term for you not feeling that you've not lived up to something. And then condemnation is the strong form, which is the sense that you feel that you could never live up to what you should live up to. And then the third is meaninglessness and purposelessness. Purposelessness is, for Tillich, the sense of I don't find any satisfaction in my job or meaning in my job. And then the strong form is I don't think there's any meaning in life at all. But what Tillich said is all of these are a type of lack. So death is a lack of life. Guilt is a lack of being, like being who you think you should be. And meaninglessness is a lack of meaning, a lack of purpose.
Guilt is a lack of being is dope. I like that a lot.
Oh, yeah.
To think of guilt as a lack of being, that's a cool thing.
Yeah, because human beings, like a dog is just a dog and a cat's a cat and a rock's a rock, but humans can be inhuman. We talk about, like, when you talk about a human, it's almost like, it's like dogs are never in-doggish. You don't have, oh, that dog is being in-doggish. A dog's nature is to be a dog.
That basset hound's acting kind of like put upon right now. Trying to impress.
Acting more like a cat or something. Yeah. But to be human is, in a sense, to experience yourself as less than human, as becoming human. And Sartre made Sartre's book, Being and Nothingness, is a beautiful reflection on this. But he says that when humans actually try to pretend that they are, you know, what they are, their nature, it looks even more stupid. So he talks about a waiter who thinks he's a waiter in a Parisian cafe and he's doing everything right. He's like so taking his job so seriously. And Sartre says, this guy's in bad faith because he thinks he's a waiter. He's not a waiter. He's that's a role he's playing. To be human is to not be, is to, in some sense, always fall short and always be developing and changing. So Sartre was very much saying to be human, he called it condemned to freedom.
I love that. It's my favorite.
It's a beautiful phrase, because you think of like freedom's wonderful, but Sartre says, no, it's terrifying, because to be free is, in a sense, to experience the idea that no one can tell you what you should do, that in some ways you have to make a decision in the dark, not knowing. And we all want to abdicate that freedom. We want someone else to tell us what to do generally. And so Sartre says at first, we experience freedom as a terrifying thing.
Like Kierkegaard said, the dizziness of freedom, isn't that
him too? That's right, the dizziness of freedom.
Yeah. Yeah. And then that quote that Sartre has, Sartre, by the way, is my favorite Game of Thrones character. That phrase goes on a lot further after that quote, and it's, I like all of it. That's even guilt, even the guilt in the more like traditional sense, when people just feel bad about crap that they've done. And from my vantage point, it's the guilt is the lack of being usually still holds true then. Like if you're guilty about some action that you did that you feel X, Y, and Z about, it usually was because you weren't really being who you were in some capacity to have like led to the action that has resulted in guilt.
Yeah, although someone like Kierkegaard would say that there is no self, that you, that that's an illusion, that there is, you know, we people talk about their authentic self and their real self. But that in one sense, the Sartre's idea is that there is no real self, that that's an illusion that's created by guilt. So, you know, it's almost like a golden age, but in the future we think, oh, this is who I really am. But actually, part of what it means to be human is to, this is actually what existentialism means. Sartre defined it as existence. This is very technical, but existence precedes essence, which means a lot of philosophers used to say that essence precedes existence, which means there's a certain way, there's a certain human nature. And when we're born, we kind of are born into it. But
is that the I think, therefore I am?
Not.
I didn't think it was. That was a dumb thing to say.
Yeah, I'm sure.
And I'm sorry.
We're not going to edit
I'm
it
I'm feeling
out.
Immense guilt for saying that. But anyway, so Essence
precedes existence, which means that, like, in a sense, an oak tree, before an oak tree, any particular oak tree is born or whatever. What do you call it? An oak tree isn't born. What is it?
It sprouts. It grows.
It grows, whatever. Sure. But it's so before it exists, the essence is already there. And it kind of, in a sense, grows into that essence. But Sartre's saying, well, no, for humans, we exist. And in a sense, our essence comes afterwards. So human beings can be a multitude of things, that there is no kind of right way to be human. There's better ways and worse ways. But for Sartre, one of the worst ways is to think that there is a right way. When people think there's a right way, it says all sorts of problems arise. So existentialism is very much go and like embrace the freedom of existence, which doesn't mean that we're not determined, but that's it's another.
Yeah, I can tell you I understood probably 80% of that, or maybe at most 80%. I think I understood 20%.
Yeah,
well, I don't even understand how percentages work. So,
at its core, I mean, you can see it very practically in the way that human beings, Sartre uses an example of a student who goes to him and says, "Listen, should I fight in the war? Fight the Germans and the Nazis, or should I help my mother, who's very elderly and ill?" And so, in other words, be a big part of something small or a small part of something very big. And there's, you know, Sartre saying, well, you know, in one sense, he's asking me because he wants me to tell him what he should do and advocate his responsibility. But in a sense, you have to make a decision in fear and trembling, unknowing. And then he also said, which is very clever, he says, when you ask me for advice, and I think it's about a different example, he says, when you ask me for advice, you already kind of know who I am. So you already kind of know what I would say. So you already know what you want to hear. You just can't take responsibility for it.
Yeah, so, man, that's in our worlds.
What's that?
That's in our worlds pretty commonly. The kind of like when people, and I've had conversations with people where I've kind of said similar stuff where they've asked for advice, and you know, it's usually people who are in their early 20s or late teens, and they're trying to figure life out, and they have a billion things going on, and they're like, you know, I know like you can't know my situation fully, and sometimes, you know, to people's credit, they can be so like aware, but I'll just be like, yeah, you're right, like I don't know your situation, I don't know what the right answer is for you, and I think it's irresponsible for me to give you anything beyond saying like, you know, you're on the right track if you're worried, and it's okay to be worried and go for it, you know, but it's like staying away from, it is interesting because, you know, it's very true. If somebody asks you, you know, questions that are burning in them, they have a feeling too that,
I mean, if you know somebody even a little bit, and you're asking them for advice, in a sense, that tells you what you want to hear, but unconsciously, you're probably not aware of it. So a good piece of advice is if you're looking for an answer to something and you intuitively go to a particular person, then you can ask yourself, oh, what kind of advice am I wanting to hear, but I'm not able to act on because I'm scared, so I need someone else to tell me. And then you can sometimes discover what you actually would like to do. Mm-hmm. It's a nice little trick to discover your own desires.
I think it's also a good sign too, if you ask for advice and you get the advice that you want and you still can't follow through with it. Because that happens all the time. And that's frustrating. That's been frustrating me over the years when people have been like, this or this. And I'm like, well, that, like, do that. And they still can't do it. And I'm like, well, what are you here for? You know, why?
Well, that's the coin flip thing. You know, that's where you flip the coin. And then if you go like, nope.
Yeah.
Or you go, yep, it tells you.
That's exactly what it is. Yeah. But it's like when the girl asks what outfit, and then you're like, or the, you ask the girl what outfit you look best in. And then she's like, don't ask my opinion if you're not going to follow it. Like, you know, when you're in a relationship, you're like, which one looks better? And you're like, that one. And I'm like, I'm going to go with this one. I'm like, okay, why'd you ask?
Yeah. I don't know.
I've heard these stories of this type of thing happening. Yeah. The idea of it.
Yeah. I mean, the way to kind of land this in a sense is to go, that at first, our first experience of the nothingness, which, say, for example, we're religious or we're very, you know, a religious background, the first experience of doubting, of questioning it all, which is the nothing where you start to go, oh my goodness, maybe I don't have the answers, maybe my community's not right. The first experience of that is really negative, and we often try to protect ourselves and like read books that will help us get rid of our doubts and unknowing. But actually the trick is to see this. Apologetics, absolutely. But the trick is to maybe go, oh no, this isn't a negative thing. This is actually a positive thing. To positivize it, to kind of go, oh, this questioning is not something to fear, but actually what is what makes life really interesting. It's what makes life really engaging.
Yeah. I know the curiosity to like, the fact that I think about things and I have an interest in these kinds of things is in and of itself sometimes comforting to me when I feel like what I'm branching into or getting into or reading about is like terrifying or different or weird. Like I can still take comfort in the fact that like, well, at least there's something to be said. And it's more fun too, to like have that kind of questioning, in my experience, have that kind of questioning, like, mind and try to have a desire to figure out the truth and see, you know, what's really going on, even though it's
absolutely
frustrating.
And until he finishes this book called The Courage to Be with this beautiful reflection, and it's a tough enough book to read sometimes, but where he says that whenever someone is in deep questioning and the things are falling apart, they experience basically this lack in their lives. At first it's terrifying, and also people try to answer the questions. People try to, if someone's questioning their religion, they try to, you know, I don't know, reaffirm it or something. But Tillich says, no, all you have to do is change how you view the doubt and see it as authentic. So in other words, if you're questioning your political views, that shows that you believe in authenticity. You believe in truth. You know, most of us just sit and watch Netflix, you know, whereas you're questioning stuff. So Tillich basically says that in the heart of authentic questioning is a beautiful affirmation of life. Now, it's not, for him, it's not a gotcha. It's not, you know, someone says, oh, I don't believe in truth. And he's like, oh, well, you do believe in truth because you're saying you don't believe in truth. And that's a truth claim. That's like first year philosophy silliness. Tillich is saying, no, when you genuinely go, I'm questioning my cultural, political, and religious background, and it really is taking up a lot of my time and thought. He says, you're showing care and concern. You're showing authenticity. You're showing that you believe that this is meaningful, and therefore you're affirming your life, you're affirming existence.
You're alive.
You're alive.
Least, yeah.
So it's kind of like, and so nothing changes. All that happens is you change how you think about it. And the way I think about it is the word unraveling. To unravel means to pull apart. To ravel also means to pull apart. It means exactly the same as to unravel, but it's much more positive sound. Doesn't have the negative un. So Tillich is just basically saying, you're not unraveling, you're raveling. Enjoy it.
Yeah, that's cool. I like that a lot. It's like, I've also noticed if there's a negative reaction or a scoffing at an interest in these kinds of things, for one, it seems to narrow conversations for me a lot, where it's like, it's a good indicator that if somebody kind of has a put offness toward deep questioning or of any kind, it usually, I'm like, oh, this I don't know how to exactly say what I'm trying to say here, but it's, I guess the flip side would be if when I find people that are interested in it or who have a mutual kind of like, there's something going on here, like the lack, the nothing, and they see it and they're trying to decipher it or figure it out or figure out what shape the nothing is in. That is the type of person who I tend to just like immediately like, okay, we can have a serious conversation. Like we can really hang out, and there's a jokingness to it. Like there's a freedom that happens just in conversing with people when you realize that they are also questioners.
Yeah. Yeah.
Deep thoughts. This has been deep thoughts with Elliot.
There is a, I know we're having to draw to a close. I want to throw this in that we could do a whole episode on this, but Lacan once defined love as giving what you don't have to somebody who doesn't want it. And one way of...
Is that a Hallmark card?
Yeah. one of the ways to interpret it, and it takes a lot of unpacking, but he says that when you first like date somebody, what you're looking for is somebody to complete you, somebody who's strong or beautiful or cool or, you know, and on Tinder, isn't it? Mm-hmm. You have people put their best foot forward and they look like they're brilliant. In fact, the one thing it looks like is that they don't need a relationship. I enjoy, you know, kite surfing and traveling and all of this stuff, right? So there's all of this positivity. But for Lacan, love really begins to grow whenever you give what you don't have, which is your lack, which basically means the things in you that you haven't lived up to, your pain, the traumas of your life, that in some ways you give that, and nobody wants that. Nobody wants your lack. They want you to complete them. You give it to someone who doesn't want it. They give their lack to you, and somehow you both treasure it. You both enjoy it.
This is an example, I think, of that happened during another podcast. I do have another podcast that I sometimes do, and I don't know if you know about it, Pete, but it's called The Valley Cast. And I was recording it last night, and a subject that came up was Disney rides. And I started to say one of my favorite Disney rides, not my all-time favorite Disney ride at Disney World, is called Mickey's PhilharMagic. And it's a 4D ride where you wear glasses and a computer-animated Mickey Mouse is a conductor. But is
four-dimensional, that just means it's in time as well as space, does it not?
Yes.
But which is everything?
It breaks down. It's a really good ride. It breaks down the space-time continuum. You end up slipping into another universe. It's incredible. No, actually what it means is they shoot blueberry-flavored air at your face when there's a pie on screen, so it's 4D. But yeah, so I love the ride, and it's a perfect ride if you go to Disney to like do first and get in the, you know, Disney-ish mood or whatever. But anyway, me and Steve Zaragoza were going back, and I'm like, I love talking about Disney. And so like, I mentioned this ride, and Steve, who also loves Disney, I see something in him switch. He's like, wait. He's like, is that the ride? And all of a sudden, I thought he was just going to describe the ride. And I was like, first of all, if you describe any Disney ride, it sounds insane. So like, don't try to like, he's like, is that the one where Mickey loses his hat and it's 10 minutes of smelling blueberry pies? I'm like, yes, that's exactly what the one I'm referring to. That's my favorite one. But as he's like,
I can't wait to find out how this connects.
It connects perfectly to Lacan's thing. This is why we do what we do.
The blueberry pie is an analogy of the nothingness.
Exactly. And that represents, and then the dancing broomsticks, you know, that's sort of the distractions that we provide ourselves to, you know, keep from confronting the abyss within. But Steve's looking at me, and it's like Steve and Lee and Joe. And then I just, as he's like looking at me, I feel myself like just kind of slump down, and I'm just like, I'm going to say exactly what's going through my mind right now. And I just go, I'm feeling very self-conscious right now, because I knew that Steve was about to attack me for my favorite Disney ride. Uh-huh. And I felt embarrassed about that. But the moment, instead of being like, you can't make fun of a Disney ride, every Disney ride is dumb, blah, 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 and just being like, this, the fact that I was like, I feel insecure about the fact that you are about to bully my, rightfully make fun of my my interest in a very cheesy Disney ride. And the moment I did it, the moment I had that like whatever moment of honesty about this lack and this insecurity that I had, it caused a lot of laughter and a lot of joy in the room, until eventually Joe was like, I just watched you wither in front of me and then come back to life. But I think it was a very, obviously it was a, you know, environment where it's like friends and all that stuff, but it was a moment of me going like, hey, I actually feel self-conscious and vulnerable about the fact that you're going to make fun of my Disney ride. And in a moment of love, they then saw that and reacted with love. Yeah. And it became something much better than having a defense mechanism for Mickey's Philhar magic.
Yeah, but and that's why parties are places that are anti-social. Because in parties, Alan de Botton talks about this, but in parties, you're always, especially LA parties, you're always trying to show your best side. You're always trying to show off. So they're actually anti getting to know someone, because the moment that you actually get to know someone is the moment when you give your vulnerability, which is the thing that you don't have, which is not your strength, your weakness, to someone who doesn't want
it. And they're never asking for it.
They're never asking for it. But weirdly, in a magical miracle moment, two people accept, even joyfully accept, the lack of the other. And parties are almost designed to not let that happen.
Yeah.
So sometimes, that, you know, if people don't like parties, they're like, oh, I don't like parties, I'm not social. But no, maybe actually you are social and you realize that parties are, in some respects, the worst place to really connect with someone.
Yeah, I was at a party of a buddy of mine, Jarrett. And it was his party, and he was throwing it, and we're kind of all hanging out. It was a lot of food. It was like a Christmassy type of thing. But the best part was like when we went outside and just hung out by ourselves for 20 minutes and talked about, you know, capitalism or whatever kind of highfalutin conversation we were having.
So have you got any takeaways then for today?
Gosh, this is where you and I really go toe to toe with equally profound observations and equally incisive. I guess if I were to take anything away from the nothing, it would be, and this is going to be me kind of, I'm shoehorning a lot of other things into this, but like the being nice to the lacks that you have, and not shaming your own or trying to cover over your own lacks, I think is a very good thing, and I think it's something that I'm working on, and it's helped so much. And I've just to have that kind of like, and then to also look at, you know, how certain thoughts and emotional reactions you have can be trying to cover those things up, and then when you like, sometimes when you look directly at them and you see whatever it is that you're in particularly lacking, it's just not that much. It's not that big of a deal when you actually look at it. But if you do it in a way that's, or I've been trying to do it in a way that's like, just kinder, because it's like not, you know, and not taking it so god dang serious. I know, and I was going to bring up, this is not a takeaway so much, but I'll just tack this on at the end. The thing you were mentioning too about people not wanting the lack that you have, I've been in relationships where I have, humble brag, I've been in relationships, plural.
Yeah.
But
your mother and your father.
And my father's an excellent second one to say. There's my mother, all of my aunts, my grandma, and my father. I've been in situations where I've very much wanted people to like show me their vulnerable side, and like even in when I was married and always kind of wanting that, like where's like the raw kind of whatever. And it's interesting because it doesn't work that way either. Like on the flip side, it doesn't work to be able to go like, you know, show, be vulnerable with me, because people don't respond well to that. So it's like in my experience that they don't want the vulnerable side. It's like you're just not going to get it when you're asking for it and looking for it. It happens when you're, like you're saying, at the party or you know, downstairs at the party or you're somewhere else, and it comes out in the...
That's why you can't kind of, you can't manage it no matter what dating app you use. And that's not, because dating apps are great, there's nothing wrong with them, but that they can't give you what they promise you. They can't give you the miracle. And by the miracle, I mean that little moment where you just randomly meet someone who you can share your lack with, they can share it with you in such a way that it works.
Yeah.
They can promise to connect you with people who are like you and who compliment you or even contrast with you in various ways. They can give you all of that, but no app can give you what sparks love. And that is this crazy, very rare and very beautiful moment where two people share their lack.
Yeah, that's beautiful.
Yeah. But a takeaway for me.
Yeah, please.
Oh, yeah. Is my thing is in our lives, family and friendships and relationships, to ask ourselves maybe, is there something that is not being spoken, that is silent? So in a family, maybe the death of someone that is never talked about, so that is always there. Or in a relationship that you have with someone, there's something like an affair or something that's just never talked about, but in a way that is in everything. It's mm-hmm. almost omnipresent because it's not being talked about. Or in your own life, something that you cannot face, but that somehow is always there. Not, you can't see it directly, but it's there like a rock. To try to perceive where that might be, and to very gradually try to, as you mentioned at the beginning, try to speak it in some way, maybe with the person. So maybe in the family, you say, listen, we need to talk about that death, you know, and cry about it together, laugh about it together, tell stories about the person who passed away and laugh about those stories and mourn together. But in one sense, somehow try to find a way to put the silence, that rock of silence, that like black hole, to try to chip away at it with words. And as you chip away with it with words, you'll maybe find that it leads to something better. It might, to be honest, lead to you breaking up with somebody, or it might lead to you having a deeper relationship with
still
them.
Consistent.
But either, what's that?
Still better.
Still better. Well, it's still better than not speaking the silence. So that's it. Is what is the unspoken in your life? And it's a lifelong thing, because there'll always be different ones. But maybe at the moment, what's the thing that's not being spoken?
Dude, I had this, and we'll talk about it. After the off the mic, but I had a
in the hot tub.
In the hot tub, you know, I don't want to come off too braggy.
I know that was a bit of a humble brag, wasn't it?
Yeah, us with our fancy hot tub shared by 800 other people.
Yeah, some of our friends wouldn't even go into, because they're sure there's a lot of germs in there.
Yeah. We just don't care if we die, so we're the. But yeah, I had a thing where I was like, you know, the lack or whatever. And I was like, why do I have this thing? And then I this is going to be speaking so vaguely, there's not gonna be anything to take away. Anyway, long story short, when I looked at what it was, I was like, oh, this is actually a positive like thing that I'm just like getting worked up. Like, it's a great thing. Like, and it last night I was just like, I was thinking and I was like, oh, I was like, this is, what am I freaking out about when the thing that is, but it's also, there's so much to this, and we are going a little over today. I think that's okay. But, being from the South, and I have a very Southern family, and a lot of my extended family, they, silence and secrecy is a golden rule down there. And it's like, you know, you don't talk about family drama. You don't, but you know, we don't talk about, and then they give you every detail that you would ever want to know about it. But we don't talk about that. Mm-hmm. You know, we don't talk. And it's like, not speaking about things has become, the way of life for it, growing up in my family. And so for me personally to take an entirely opposite approach to that is an ongoing, difficult, and so far very good and healthy process.
Yeah. I think it's difficult for all of us in different ways.
Yeah.
Like every culture has its, you know, repressions, and every culture has its rituals that try to bring them to the surface. So in our culture, the pub, like having a drink at the pub, is a ritual that attempts to try to get you to speak about stuff. Mm-hmm. You go for a drink with your friends, but every culture has rituals that attempt to bring the truth to the surface, because every culture has difficulty with it.
Yeah, the prayer chain thing.
Prayer chain.
Yeah, I just want to pray for so and so. So and so had an affair, and so and so was hooked on drugs, and so and so. Yeah, but I mean, that's not so much a pub. You know, that's not a healthy thing. That's just a.
Oh yeah, because there's a good healthier. There's a good story about that. I remember there's about a kid who is praying with his mother and grandmother, and he's saying, "God bless my family, and God bless my grandmother," and then really loud says, "And God, get me a blue bike for Christmas."
Yeah.
And the mother says, "You don't have to shout, God's not deaf." And he says, "Yes, but grandma is." Right. So in other words, you say you're praying to God, but you're actually praying to everybody else. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that is a ritual that allows for people to speak the unspeakable. Mm-hmm. So it's a very useful ritual.
And it keeps them from the sin of gossip, which keeps them from the guilt, which keeps them from the lack of being. Thank you, everybody.
I thought that was a good end.
I think, yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah,
there you go.
Now we're still going, though.
Yeah, okay. Well,
what if it ends up being a 2-hour? We should end it now. Okay.
Okay.
I hate ending on this thing I say. You should say something that's extra profound, and that way it'll be the... Say, that's like a dance, monkey dance.
Yeah, no, I've got nothing to say.